Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Hello. Thank you for coming out. Before we get started tonight, we have a little business we have to conduct. Did we get matches? All right. Well, that's the first. Hold on. Give me 1 second. Here we go. All right.
Okay. Y'all are going to be on Facebook later on tonight.
So, friend me, follow me, like me. It's like the mantra that we have to live with these days, right? We are such need for engagement with people. We have to get friended, followed, and liked on Facebook and on Twitter. So that I got that picture. The second thing I have to do is they gave me this. It's a electronic device. On this device, when I turn it on, it makes it. Oh, look, there's a picture of me climbing a tree. That's kind of cool. Anyway, they you can sign up for my when I'm signing, you can sign up for my my newsletter, my mailing list, and I won't use it. I won't give it to anybody. But the every couple of months, I put out a newsletter, and it has exciting tidbits of information that you may not, you know, be aware of. For instance, did you realize that we just recently sold the Reader's Digest condensed edition of The Art of Racing in the Rain in Slovakia. So if any of you have family in the old country with short attention spans, they too can enjoy The Art of Racing in the Rain. So sign up for my newsletter. And thirdly, there's a speech I give at every reading, and it's an obligation, so I'm just going to have to do it. I'll try and make it as short as I can, but I got to tell you something. I write novels. I don't write haikus. So when I say it's going to be short, it's not going to be 17 syllables. I apologize in advance. My job as a writer isn't just to write books. It's to get people to read books. And a book is a conversation. It's a conversation between a reader and a writer. And so an unread book is really worthless. It's just a very colorful doorstop. It's a heavy thing. You can use it to weight down your pie crust or something like that. The book has to be read in order for it to be of worth. That's the whole point of it. And so the reader has to then pick it up and invest in it. I would love to go around and put my books into everybody's hands and say, now read this book. And here, like I do with my seven-year-old, I'll say, I'll start the sentence and then you're going to keep going. But I can't. It's just physically impossible. So I need deputies, and those deputies have already infiltrated your communities. These deputies are really wonderful people. They're very valuable people for me as a writer. They're valuable for you as readers. These people are booksellers and librarians. And they're there because they have a passion for the written word. They're not there to get rich quick, trust me. They're there because they love reading. They love books. They love talking about books. They love engaging with people, about sharing books with people. And so it's kind of a big thing. So I want to make sure that we acknowledge them and that we make sure that they remain in existence. Because it's a tough world out there. And there's a lot of competition. And the internet, as you know, is everywhere. And it's easy to do the one-click thing, and then the next day a nice man in a brown uniform comes and hands you a box, and you don't even have to put on your shoes. But I encourage you to take the extra few steps and spend the extra few cents to support your local bookstores. Parnassus Books, for instance. and also, since, you know, I also encourage you very much to support your library systems. I don't know how you guys vote here, if it's levies or if what the system is for funding. I encourage you always to support the funding of your public library systems. Also, you can support them in many other ways as well, through volunteering your time, through donations, even by checking out books. You're helping your library system because you're increasing the circulation numbers, and that's how they get their grants. So we need our libraries. They serve a much broader of segment of our population than you probably can imagine. And it's not just about checking out books. It's about providing computers and online internet service for people who don't have access to computers. It's providing English as a second language programs, story time for kids, satellite libraries. You know, it really is a web that keeps our communities vibrant, because this is what's important. What we're losing in this, I get political, sorry. I'm not going to get that political, kind of gently political. So I believe that with this whole, you know, the internet is so great. It gives us everything we could need on the touch of our fingertips, right? And we can just sculpt the kind of information that we want to come to us. We can pick and choose the streams of news and op-ed pieces and so forth that get to us. And if we're really good about it, we can make it so that we hear nothing that disagrees with our opinions. You think it's funny, but it's not. It's actually very serious. Because what our society is based on is the idea of civil discourse. It's the idea to agree to disagree. It's the idea to exchange ideas. And maybe I don't go all the way to your side, you don't come all the way to my side, but we agree to meet somewhere in the middle. That's how we, remember that from high school? Thesis, antithesis, synthesis? So that's what we have to maintain in our communities. And when we lose it, what happens? Nothing happens. Everything shuts down. We can see it happening every day if we just turn on one of our favorite news streams and see what's going on with the federal government. Nothing. They're not passing any laws. They're not, no judges are being are being approved. It doesn't exist, because everyone's got their fingers in their ears and they're making a lot of noise. They're not listening to the other side. So we need to listen to the other people around us. How do we do that? In our communities, we can do that. On our main streets, that's where we do that. In our bookstores, in our libraries, on the businesses right down over here on Broadway, we do that. We come to, we meet people who have different experiences than us, who come from different backgrounds from us, and then we listen to what they have to say, and we say, oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. Well, there you go. That's it. That's all. It's as simple as that. I hadn't thought of it that way. That's interesting. Let me go think about that. That's society. That's our community at work. So we need to make sure that our main streets remain vibrant places. We need to make sure that we have reading material for all people, no matter what their situation is. And we need to make sure that we maintain a situation of civil discourse in our communities, so that we can progress, we can move forward, we can empathize with people who have different experiences than us. Okay, I start rambling. Sorry, that's it. No more lecture. Support your libraries and independent booksellers. So I had this like really cool thing happen. You know, I had this idea. I used to make documentary films, this film came across my desk, and it was from Mongolia, and it was about this belief among the nomadic people in Mongolia that the next incarnation for their dog will be as a person. And I thought, wow, that's really kind of cool idea, right? So, you know, whatever. I kind of tucked the idea into the back of my head, and then I for years didn't do anything about it. And then I was hold on.
Hello.
Can I move around? That makes me feel like pseudo presidential. I don't like that. I like to move a little bit. So I went on, I did other things after I was doing documentaries. I wrote a couple of books and all that. And then I went to a poetry reading by Billy Collins. You guys familiar with Billy Collins? I'm sure he's been here, right? Billy Collins has been everywhere. He's amazing. He's a terrific poet. He's really charismatic. His poetry is fantastic. And this was in 2006. He was in Seattle, and he read one of his poems. I was at this big reading at Benaroya Hall. And he read one of his poems called The Revenant, which means words from the dead. So it's told from the point of view of a dog who's recently been euthanized. So it's being narrated from doggy heaven. And the first line of the poem is this. I am the dog. Wait, hold on a second. I am the dog you... I am the dog you put to sleep, as you like to call the needle of oblivion. Come back to tell you this simple thing. I never liked you. Right? It's very funny. It's a very funny poem. And it goes on and on and on about how the dog hates his master and how the jangling of my collar drove me mad and you always scratched me in the wrong places and all this kind of stuff. Very, very funny. And this light bulb went on in my head and I said, you know, that idea about a dog being reincarnated as a person, that's a great idea, but it can only be told from the point of view of a dog. The dog wanting to be reincarnated, thinking to himself, I'm smarter than everybody else in this room. My tongue won't make clever sounds, and my thumbs, I don't have thumbs, so I can't open doors. So I had this idea, and I said, so I quickly started writing this idea of this book, The Art of Racing in the Rain. It became 4 months later, I had finished the first draft of the book. I've never written that fast before. It just came like magic. And I sent it off to my agent in New York, and I waited patiently for him to call me. And he finally called a couple weeks later. And I remember the day specifically. It was the Tuesday before Thanksgiving in 2006. I remember this because I'm from Seattle. I lived in New York for a long time, though. I went to school there and then stayed for 18 years. And I met my wife there, and we had two of our three beautiful children were born in New York. And then in 2001, we moved back to Seattle. And I knew this was difficult for my in-laws, who are New Yorkers, because, you know, I took their daughter and their two grandchildren away from them. And I felt really bad about that, but it was a better situation for us in Seattle. So I was going to pick up a Thanksgiving turkey on this Tuesday before Thanksgiving, because I do all the cooking in our house and the Thanksgiving cooking and all that. And my in-laws were coming into town for their very first Thanksgiving in Seattle. So it was a big deal, because I had to show off that, you know, I didn't like abduct their daughter and their grandchildren, that they were thriving in Seattle. It was a bit, I had to impress them. So I had to go to Whole Foods to get one of those special turkeys, right? Because you got to get the one that costs more, because it must be better if it costs more. So I was going into Whole Foods, and my cell phone rang, and it was my agent. And I thought, this is brilliant, because not only am I going to be able to prove to my in-laws how good a cook I am and how their daughter and grandchildren are thriving, but now my agent's going to tell me how smart I am and that I can add that on. They're going to love me. And so I picked up my cell phone. I said, so what do you think? And my agent was there, and he said to me, it's narrated by a dog. And I said, yes, I know that. Having written it. I said, what did you think about the book? And he said to me, I can't sell a book narrated by a dog. No one will buy a book narrated by a dog. No publisher will publish a book narrated by a dog. No marketing department would even know how to market a book narrated by a dog. It's not even narrated by a dog, he said. It's narrated by an author pretending to be a dog. To which I said, you know, Victor Hugo wasn't a hunchback. I don't think he got that joke, because he went on and on and on at great length. He must not have ever read Victor Hugo. He went at great length about, the state of the industry, and this is a very important book for you. This is your third book. I had written two books before that, got nice critical reviews, but didn't sell very well. He's like, this is like really crucial. You need to, this is really important. And he ended his whole speech with, do me a favor, go throw this book away and go write me a book I can sell. And I was kind of devastated, right? And I don't know what got into me, my in-laws coming into town, the stress of all that or something, or the holiday season, I don't know. But these two words came into my head, and not those two words, two other words. And I felt compelled to say them, so I did. I just said them right there. I said, you're fired. So I fired my agent. Let me give you a little bit of advice. If you're a writer, and you're working on your third novel, and your first novels, you know, people, you know, good reviews, and everyone who read them loved them, but very few people read them, that kind of thing. If you're working on your third novel, and let's just pretend it's narrated from an alternative point of view, let's say a dog, for instance, and let's say that you're gonna get in a fight with your agent about this, and you're gonna fire your agent over it, and it's the Tuesday before Thanksgiving when your in-laws are coming in for a big, gigantic Thanksgiving dinner. It's best not to tell your spouse about it until after Thanksgiving. It's just not worth it. But we got through the weekend, and everything was fine, and I started sending out my book to other agents, and I got the same response. Same response over and over again. Like the writing, like the story, like the idea, like all that, but we don't, it's narrated by a dog. How do we sell this book? We don't know how to sell the book. So I was really frustrated. I was really at wit's end. And it was in later in the spring of 2007, there was a fundraiser for King County Library Systems, which is our library system up in the Northwest. And they do a gala every spring called Literary Lions. They have 35 writers and 35 tables. And every course, they ring a bell and the writers get up and move to a different table so they can talk to other people. It's a ton of fun. Writers love it. The patrons love it. It's really a blast, and I do it whenever I can. I was doing it that year, and I was at the pre-author dinner. You know why they have a pre-author dinner at this kind of event? You know, it's kind of like being at your own wedding where, you know, you don't get to eat any of the food. Yep. Do you even remember what they served? Because everyone's talking to you, and you can't even get a mouthful. But there are these really helpful people in white coats who pour wine, and so it's like an ever refilling wine glass. And so the writers get really drunk because they're not eating, but they're drinking a lot of wine. And so they learned after the first year when they rang the third bell and they had 35 drunken writers staggering around the room looking for table numbers, give the writers some food first. Fill their stomachs, and then we. So I was at the pre-author dinner, and I was sitting at a table with other writers, and it came around to me. We were introducing ourselves. It came to me, and I said, "Hi, my name is Garth, and I'm really frustrated because I have this book, and I think it's really good, but no agent will even touch it because it's narrated by a dog." And this other writer sitting across the table from me looked up from his plate, and he said, "Oh, hey, you should talk to my agent. He sold my book, and it's narrated by a crow." I don't see why he couldn't sell the book narrated by a dog. This is a true story. Lane Mayhew wrote a book called Song of the Crow about a crow who stows away on Noah's Ark. So I got his agent's information, and it's a good book. I sent my stuff off to his agent, and he called me up 2 days later, and he was crying, and he said, "I love this dog and I love this book. You have to let me represent this book." And that's the guy I needed. And we worked on it a little bit, and then he sent it out and got a great deal with my terrific publisher, Harper. And it went on to sell, 4 million copies in 35 languages, 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list. And they're making it into a movie, theoretically. We'll see if that happens. But meanwhile, the point is, you can write a book. People will read a book narrated by a dog. I guess that's the moral of the story. But you can't live forever on a dog book. Well, you probably can if you want to be a hermit, but I want to be a writer, so I had to write another book. And I had written a play in 2004 before I wrote The Art of Racing in the Rain. Kind of on a whim. It was an idea that I had that it would be a kind of American Gothic story, and there would be this one set, and the set would make noise. It would be this house, and it would make noise. It would creak, and it would groan, and it would interact with the other characters on the stage. And the other characters were going to be this big dysfunctional family, and it was this timber family, because if you write about the Northwest, at some point you have to write about timber, because it's all about the timber industry in the Northwest. So I had this thing, and I wrote this play, and it was called Brother Jones. It had one production in Los Angeles in 2005. It was very successful, got nice reviews in the local papers. But there was something about it that wasn't quite right, and I knew that. And I knew that to take it to the next level, I would have to workshop it. I'd have to get actors and really drill down into it to figure out how to make it work. And I didn't have time to do that because I had this idea about a book narrated by a dog, and that sort of consumed my time. At some point, people started saying, "Well, so what's your next book? What's your next book?" And so I thought, you know what? I want to work with those characters some more that I had in this play. I liked them a lot, and I want to see what's about this family that really works. And with theater, I love theater because it's about the immediacy of the drama. It's about actors interacting on stage in front of our very eyes, and part of that is, that's what makes it so compelling. Novels, though, give us another element. We're allowed to go way back into the history of how we got to the now. So it's really more about building like all the whole backstory. So I decided to write this, to embark on this book. Let me just read, I'm just going to read a couple of short passages, but so bear with me, but because I know reading tends to be boring, but I'll try to make it really exciting. This is just from the very, very beginning in the prologue of A Sudden Light. Prologue, the title is The Curse. Growing up in rural Connecticut, I had been told the name Riddell meant something to people in the Northwest. My paternal great-great-grandfather was someone of significance, my mother explained to me. Elijah Riddell had accumulated a tremendous fortune in the timber industry, a fortune that was later lost by those who succeeded him. My forefathers had literally changed the face of America with axes and two-man saws and diesel donkeys to buck the fallen, with mills to pulp the corpses and scatter the ashes. They carved out a place in history for us all, and that place, I was told, was cursed. So our book begins with Trevor Riddell, who's the youngest in the line of the Riddell family. He's 38 years old. He has two daughters. He has a wife, and he brings them back. He hasn't lived in this area for a long time. He brings them back to the Northwest, to the site of the North Estate, which is where his family's estate was. And when he brings them there, he brings them there for a purpose. He wants to tell them the story of what happened to him when he was 14 years old. So the bulk of the story takes place with Trevor Riddell as a 14-year-old in 1990. So I wanted to have this idea of him being isolated. You know, 1990 was all pre-internet. There was some stuff out there, but it was before like the explosion of the, you know, we used to have to like call, you used to have to dial in 1990 if you did internet at all. And there were very few cell phones. If there was like the one guy you knew who had a cell phone, right? But it was like really big, and he wouldn't ever turn it on because the roaming charges were too high. So there was a sense of isolation about this world. There weren't 300 channels on Comcast. There was no on-demand, no iPads, all this kind of thing. So that's the era that the story takes place. So to kind of tell you a little bit, to set this up a little bit, bear with me. I need you to imagine something here. So we're going to do like a community like session of bonding here. So imagine this. You're a 14-year-old boy in 1990. You're pretty happy. You're pretty smart. You've lived in Connecticut. You grew up in Connecticut in a little farmhouse that your father owned. Your father's always been kind of a very reticent guy. He's doesn't talk about his family at all. You've never met any of his family members. You don't know anything about his family history. He's just sort of this cipher, in a sense, to you. He builds wooden boats for a living. He builds them in painstakingly by hand in the old art of wooden boat building. He makes enough, somewhat, I guess, to keep you in this little farmhouse, but he doesn't make too much. Your mother is quite brilliant. She's from England originally. She has a PhD in comparative literature from Harvard University. She's constantly reading books. The house is filled with books stacked up. Everywhere you go, you can't get around the books. And so therefore, you start reading these books. She gives you books to read. She says, you know, it's time for you to read Arthur Koestler's Darkness at Noon, for instance. Why anyone would tell a 14-year-old to do that? My mother did. So you've been exposed to quite a bit of literature, right? And then the bottom falls out. Things are bad between your parents. Your father's business goes under. And then they have to declare bankruptcy. And then, because of the strain of all this, they decide to separate. Your mother goes off to England to visit with her family, to stay with her family, still living in Cornwall. And your father takes you, finally, to your ancestral home in the Pacific Northwest. You go there with your father. You take this long plane flight. You drive. You go for miles. And then you end up going through this very long, a gated community. What? My father grew up in a gated community. You didn't know that? Yes. You go through a gated community down a long, winding road. And finally, you end up at this amazing piece of property, 204 acres, on a bluff overlooking Puget Sound. And if you've been to the Northwest, you know it's Puget Sound and then the Kitsap Peninsula on the other side and the Olympic Mountains on the in the far distance. And trees are everywhere, trees everywhere. And you go and you look across this field when you drive up for the first time and you see the house, the little cottage where your father grew up, is this gigantic mansion. It's 50 bedrooms at least. It's got fireplaces everywhere. And it's gigantic. And what's most remarkable about it is it's made out of whole trees with bark on them as columns holding up the structure. So you can see this whole, and you're like, I totally don't understand what's happening here. Your father takes you closer to the house, and you get there and you realize the house is rotting. It's falling apart. There's no money. At some point, one of your ancestors, Elijah Riddell, your great-great-grandfather, had a huge amount of money. He was the most influential timber baron in the Northwest. But all of it was lost by the generations in between. And all that's left is this gigantic mansion on this bluff. And it's crumbling. It's really falling apart. And there's no money to maintain it. Your father takes you inside. You go in, you see how everything is still there. It's like a museum. It smells like a mothball kind of, and dusty. But then you look, and over there, there's a portrait, 8 feet tall, of this guy, crazy looking guy with long white hair, and he's reaching out of the portrait. Like, it's sort of this weird, and so it seems like he's trying to pull you into the portrait. And you look at it and say, who the heck is that? And your father tells you, that's your great-great-grandfather, Elijah Riddell. He built this house. So you start to learn about the family history. Now, there are only two relatives left, and you haven't met them. You go in and you meet, of course, you meet the fabulous Serena, your father's sister. Serena, who when you were told you were going to meet your aunt, you thought, well, she's going to be like Mrs. Doubtfire, right? She's going to be kind of dowdy and this and that. Oh, I'm going to take care of you. No. She's 35 years old. She's smoking hot. She's got this weird affectation. She talks like she's out of an old movie or out of old books or something. Everything's kind of strange with her. She walks around barefoot constantly, and she's got her toenails painted this bright blue that is mesmerizing to you as a 14-year-old. That can set you off. And she's really kind of, what game she's playing, you don't understand. And then you meet your grandfather. He is just he also with long white hair, kind of seemingly out of control, dressed. When you first meet him, he's wearing a black t-shirt that has sentences written on it, and it says, God was my co-pilot, but then we crashed in the mountains and I had to eat him. I mean, this is an old man wearing this, it's so irreverent. Trevor, you don't even understand what's going on. And yet you try to make sense of it, but you're put in a weird position. Your mother is very far away in England, many time zones away, and she's hard to get a hold of. And when you do get a hold of her, she seems very distant emotionally as well as physically. Your father is reticent at best. He just isn't giving you anything. Your aunt is always playing games with you. Everything's a duel. You ask a question, she asks you three questions back. And your grandfather may or may not have dementia. It's hinted that he may have Alzheimer's of some degree. We don't know. There's no one to trust. So what do you do as a 14-year-old? You explore. You're left to your own devices. You don't have the internet. You don't have the television. There's no VCR. You start exploring the house, and you start digging into it. And these old houses were amazing when they built these around the 1890s and the turn of the 20th century. You know, they built them. It was a very class structure back then. Well, we had servants, and the servants were supposed to, you know, this were much larger, 20 servants for a family of four, no problem. Things were supposed to appear, and not, we shouldn't see the servants, things should just appear. And so there were actually like hidden panels in the walls for the servants to use, back stairs, servant stairs, right? So there are all these places that a kid could dig into and sort of figure out the web of this house. And maybe you stumble across some letters written by one relative to another in the old days, and maybe you stumble across a diary or a journal or something, and you start to piece some things together. And if you listen really carefully, maybe you hear some sounds, maybe some creaks, maybe some sighing, maybe a couple words, maybe you hear your name a couple times. And if you really, really believe, maybe you understand that there's someone else in the house, just not of sound body, Maybe there's a spirit in the house, and maybe that's the only thing, the only person you can trust. So let me read you a little quick thing. This is just to give you a taste of what how Serena runs the household. I love Serena. She's a terrific character. This is the very first they arrive. Trevor and his father, Jones, arrive. They have their first dinner in the house. Serena hasn't seen her brother in 23 years. He's an older brother, and she's really so excited to see him. She cooks this entire dinner, enough for 20 people, but there are only four of them there. And the only thing you need to know for this is that Grandpa Samuel won't eat the chicken because chicken has tendons. I don't know why that matters to him, but it does. Where were we? Serena asked, rolling her eyes. Oh, yes, the question of haunting. Jones, haven't you had the talk with Trevor? What's the talk? I asked. The talk about states of being, states of awareness. We had the talk around the dinner table nightly when your father and I were young. Our mother lectured us about it incessantly. I mean, there's so much we don't know. How can we consider ourselves to know anything at all? Daddy, I really must insist that you eat some chicken. Serena picked up a piece of fried chicken with her tongs and placed it on Grandpa Samuel's plate. He recoiled and shoved the thigh off his plate and onto the tabletop. Is there an entity in this house? I asked. Define entity, Serena said. We must use the proper nomenclature. Terminology can be confusing unless we're agreed on the definitions. Knock it off, Serena, my father growled. For real, you're scaring him. I think Trevor knows more than you're giving him credit for. He's the one who asked. Serena stood up and grabbed a box of matches from the counter next to the big old-fashioned stove. She dropped the box on the table before me and then resumed her seat. There are all sorts of hiding places in this house, she said. When Riddell House was built, there were many things to be afraid of. Not Indians, of course. The Northwest Coast natives were a docile lot, happily trading with each other and the white men alike. But there were bandits and thieves who targeted the very rich. They would kidnap and ransom family members when they could. At least that's what Elijah believed, though he was a noted misanthrope, so grains of salt should be taken as necessary. Nevertheless, this house was designed with secret passages and places to hide so Elijah could feel safe. They call them priest holes, a term held over from the Reformation in England when Catholics would hide their priests from the Protestant establishment. Do you know what they did when they discovered a priest hiding in the walls during the Reformation? What did they do? I asked. They hanged him, or they burned him alive. A good hanging has its drama, but there's nothing like the scent of burning flesh lingering in the air to roust a priest or two from his hidey hole, I'm sure you can imagine. Serena, my father scolded. There's a secret stairway in Riddell House, Serena continued without a pause. I don't know where. It's a secret, isn't it, Jones? A secret you shared with Mother. I was too young to be allowed in on the secret. There's a hidden stairway, Trevor, and if you find it and strike a match, you will see an apparition in the sudden flash of light. The ghost of Riddell House. But we shouldn't talk about this. It upsets Daddy. Daddy finds talk of spirits very disturbing. You remember the night Daddy took the axe to the stairs, don't you, Brother Jones? I shouldn't have come here, my father grumbled, exasperated. Perhaps not, Serena said. And yet you're here. You came here with some amount of deliberation. You didn't fall through the floorboards and find yourself at Riddell House. You got on a plane. You checked luggage. You rented a car. Daddy, please put your chicken back on your plate and eat it. Eat all of it, tendons included, or else you will weaken, fall, and break your hip. And studies show that once mobility is diminished by a broken hip, life expectancy is greatly decreased. So that gives you an idea of how Serena runs the household. Everybody's off balance. She's always going one direction and then another, and always a game being played. And Trevor is trying to play that game with her. No one else seems up to it. Everyone else just says, whatever you say, Serena. Trevor tries to take her on. I want to read one more passage. Because what happens is Trevor, as he begins to explore the house, he begins to understand that he has someone he can look into. He becomes He understands that the house has a personality and has a, it almost seems alive. It almost seems like it's growing. So let me just read this little brief passage about a house, and then we can do some questions and stuff like that. We were more than a week into our stay, 10 days by the calendar, and I had taught myself how to walk down the long hallways without making a sound. I had familiarized myself with all the stairways that were obvious and some that were not. Back stairs in front, servant stairs in front of house. I had found linen closets with hidden panels to store things. What was stored in these places over the decades, I didn't know. I understood Riddell House in a way I could only describe as fundamental. Sometimes when I walked down the long corridor at night and ventured into the south wing, I felt as if I had become the house. The house told me where to turn, where to go next, what to discover. And when I stopped in a room with my during my nightly explorations, I always knew Ben was there with me. Because I breathed with measured breaths, and I didn't move a gram of body weight, I made no sound. I waited until Ben's shallow breath fell out of sync with mine, and I could hear us both breathing. I didn't want anything from Ben but the truth. He was there when my grandmother died. He knew what happened between my father and his mother and father. He seemed to be the only one who was willing to tell me anything. I stood in a room that was entirely empty except for a bare mattress on a metal frame. The moon shone across the water and tickled the ceiling and walls with flecks of light. I heard Ben's breath, independent of my own, so I knew he was with me. He placed his hand on my shoulder and leaned toward me so I could feel his phantom weight, and he whispered my name. "Tell me," I said, but he said nothing. That night, I had another dream. So this is when Trevor is starting to really establish a relationship with this spirit, and the spirit talks to him by giving him dreams. He gives him dreams that have the history of the house or history of things that have happened in the house, where Trevor starts to learn things about his ancestors generations removed. The book is dedicated. The dedication of it is odd, maybe, to some people, not to me, but it's dedicated to my dead father. When I did that, my publisher called me up immediately and said, I'm not sure about this dedication. It seems a little angry. And I said, yes, it is. A little angry, I guess. I admit that, but it's important. So when I was first starting to conceive of after I'd written the play and I came back to the novel, when I was first starting to work on the novel, I was understanding what it was really about. And so it's about, there's a lot of fathers and sons and relationships between fathers and sons in the novel. So when this was happening, when I was dealing with the early going stages of this, my father got a bad lung ailment. We still don't know what it was. They kept asking questions like, has he been to the Sahara Desert? And has he been sweeping out mouse droppings from an attic or something? Clearly references to different hantaviruses and SARS and this sort of things that, assaults the lung that are inexplicable. He went to the hospital. At some point in the hospital, you get sick of being in the hospital. And, 5 weeks later, curtains for Marvin. He was done. He passed on. We dealt with the aftermath of that. That's what dads do. Dads die. It's part of life. We did what we had to do. And then several months later, I had a series of dreams. They were kind of strange. They were maybe five dreams in a row, maybe four. It was either four or five nights in a row. I had dreams where my father came to me in the night, and we had these long conversations about nothing, about something, about things, about banal things, but also about important things. Just long conversation, not repetitive at all. It wasn't like the same dream over and over. It was different dreams five nights in a row. And then after that, he was gone. I haven't seen him since. Now, we're so scientific in our culture right now, in our society, right? We explain everything with science. It's so easy to explain everything with science. But it really isn't that easy. I mean, it is sometimes when we use some of the sciences that we use right now. But if you think forward, if you read any Stephen Hawking, if you even read old Albert Einstein, if you think about the idea of the unified field theory, the idea that Einstein was working for is bringing the spirit and science together rather than trying to separate them apart, maybe maybe we're in a different position. But right now, what do? We explain everything away. Oh, that's easy. You had pepperoni pizza that night, and you were traumatized by your father's death, and then you had your synapses fired randomly, and of course, these images would come up, right? Okay, that's an easy answer. But I'm not sure it's the correct answer, because I think that for me, I don't like to think of it that way. I like to say my father was 75 years old. He walked 4 miles a day. He did yoga twice a week. It was not his time to die. So when he did die, he had something unresolved. He needed to complete something. And so he came to me. Maybe he went to my sister as well. Maybe he went to my mother. I don't know. They never told me anything. But he came to me. And he had these things, and he had to deliver some messages, and he did. And then he was gone. He went about his journey. I haven't seen him since. That then implies that there's something beyond, that we need to look beyond the obvious, that there's a spiritual journey that we're all on, that the things that we call coincidences or luck aren't coincidences, and they're not luck. They are connections that we don't have the capacity to see, because we depend on trying to explain everything a little too clearly. So if we want to believe in the magic and the spirituality behind it, then we can say, okay, it makes sense to me. How easy is it for a spirit to come back in a dream? You don't have to get a physical aspect at all. You can just come into someone and give them something, right? And the more I say this, I've been going around the country a lot and saying these same sort of things, and people say, you know, my mother came to me, and my father came to me, and my sister, you know, this is somewhat of a common experience. So I like to think that my father really affected the trajectory of this book in not just in his life, by raising me and being a good father and all that, but in his death and in his spiritual aspect as well. That's why I wanted to dedicate it to my dead father. It's a book about fathers and sons. It's a book about our connection with nature. It goes into all sorts of stuff about transcendentalism and the ideas of the early Riddell family in the 1890s, dealing with the conservation movement that was started by Teddy Roosevelt, of course, or taken up by Teddy Roosevelt and his forestry lieutenant, Gifford Pinchot. By the way, both of them big spiritualists. Gifford Pinchot, you know, married his dead fiancée. And had dinner with her every night for like years. She wasn't there, but she was there in spirit. So it has all this kind of stuff in it, but it's also about looking beyond, trying to peel back the layers, and trying to say, put a little magical realism in our lives. So that's the idea of A Sudden Light. I hope you enjoy it. And if you do, please tell your friends and relatives about it. I have a cool website, asuddenlight.com, that has like some really neat information, the stuff that I haven't put in the book, because you can only put so much in a book. So there's stuff about timber barons, railroad barons, spirituality, spiritualism, tree climbing. There's tree climbing in this book. A couple of the guys in the 1890s are just love, they're loggers, but they also love climbing trees to be one with the tree. So I learned about this. I read this fabulous book by Richard Preston called The Wild Trees. And I'm anticipating a question. So pretend that you just start asking a question. Someone just said, what about tree climbing? Okay, so because I don't want to forget about it, because it's pretty cool. I read this book and I thought, I need to know about this. I need to know what it's like to be at the top of a tree. And one of the people in the book, that when I was doing the research of this, didn't live very far away from me, pretty easy to contact down in Portland, Oregon, by the name of Tim Kovar. And do we have Amy here? There's Amy. Tim's wife is here now. And Tim is totally cool guy. I mean, how can you not be a cool guy? You know what he does? He climbs trees for a living. Hello? So I said, Tim, you got to teach me how to climb trees. So he taught me there are different kinds of techniques depending on the tree. And I said, this is good. I like climbing these trees and all, but I need to get up. I need to know what it's like to be way up. And so last August, Tim called me up and he's like, I can get you up into a redwood in California. You want to go? And I was like, I'm there. So he and I climbed up a 800-year-old redwood tree in California. And it was, I put a video, I made a video. I carried one of those GoPro deals on my helmet. And so I made it like a 3-minute video. It's on the asuddenlight.com website. And it's really an amazing experience. It's scary. It's unbelievably frightening for the first, 120 feet or so. Because there are no branches down there, and you're like on a rope that's as thick as your thumb, and you're using these ascenders, and you're kind of sitting in this little saddle deal, and you go up 6 inches at a time. And at some point around 90 feet, you tend to like look down, just instinct. And you look down, you look between your feet, and you can see exactly where you're going to die. It's like, right, I'm going to go straight down. There's nothing going to break my fall. And so it's a little frightening. But once you get up higher into the tree, that's when the branches are, they're huge, and it's the network of the branches, and you feel held, you can't see the ground anymore, and you feel held by the tree, and you really, there's a different relationship you have when you're 200 feet in the tree than when you're on the ground looking up at it. Part of it is that you're clinging to the tree for your life, but part of it is that you realize that this is an actual living being, and there's a certain mysticism to it. There's the idea that how many winters has this tree seen? How many snowfalls? How many rainstorms? How many lightning strikes? How many sunsets? So it was really very magical and cool to have that. Tim and I climbed it a couple times that day, and the second time we climbed, it was at sunset. And we got to the top just as the sun was going below the horizon, and it was quite beautiful. And we stayed up there for a while and enjoyed that, and then we descended, and by the time we got down to the bottom, it was completely dark on the forest floor. And so you really understand, it was like we went into an entire different environment and then returned to Earth. And there really is this thing that, as Tim calls it, there's tree time. It's a different, the clock is different on tree time. It's not about something he told me and something that's in the book. It's not about going somewhere. It's not about getting somewhere. It's about being somewhere. And we do tend to lose sight of that in our society where everything's so quick, we can do everything in an instant. It's nice to have tree time. So anyway, that was one of your questions. Do I have any other questions? Are there any other questions? No, there are no other questions? Yes, sir.
Can you tell us about your band?
The question is, can I tell you about my band? Yes, we have a band called The Rejections and Trailing Spouses and Sometimes Offspring. That's the newest, latest thing. The Rejections is a band of authors. It's a bunch of writers in Seattle, and we get together and we practice every Tuesday night, and then we do gigs, usually around book readings. We have a couple of really talented people in the band. I'm not one of them. I play the bass, but I got to be honest with you. I started playing the bass many, many years ago, but I started playing only for one reason. I wanted to, there was this really cute girl drummer. Girl drummers are really cute. And I really wanted to get together with her. And I thought if I could learn how to play the bass, maybe we could be a rhythm section together. Anyway, we're still married. So it seemed to work. But I play a little bit of the bass. And then there's Jenny Shortridge, who wrote Love, Water, Memory. Stephanie Kalos, who wrote Broken for You, is in there. And then there are husbands. Paul Mars is the husband of Lori Frankel, who's a writer. And Ben Bauermeister is the husband of Erica Bauermeister, an author. So everybody's associated with an author in some degree. And when I can't make it, my 18-year-old son, who's a future rock star, his band Modern Tribes, check it out on Facebook, he sits in for me on bass. We have a lot of fun doing it. The talented people write songs, they mash songs together, and so we do things that are appropriate to whatever venue we're playing. Like we did, Carol Casella writes these thrillers, kind of literary thrillers, I guess, about, she's an anesthesiologist, and she writes medical things about anesthesiology. That's like one of the hardest words to say on the planet. And so we had to learn, Pink Floyd, Comfortably Numb, and The Smiths, Girlfriend in a Coma. All right, next question. Yes, ma'am.
Have you ever talked again with your agent that you fired?
Have I ever spoken again with my former agent? Yeah, we see him pretty regularly. He works for UPS and delivers our... No, that's mean. I shouldn't say that. No, I don't know. I have not. You know, these things happen. They happen. Every agent has a story about the one that got away, and it's totally understandable, I guess, from an objective point of view, but I do still resent the fact that he told me to throw the book away. I do. Because I'm an emotional person, and I carry it with me. I do hold grudges. Sorry, you're learning too much about me right now. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
When I bought Racing in the Rain, I'd be walking down the street and people would rush up to me saying, that's the best book in the world, stuff like that. After it got published, how quickly did that spin start happening?
So the question is, how quickly did Racing in the Rain become so like ubiquitous, right? It seemed like everybody had it. It was weird. You know, people sometimes say, well, when did you know with Racing in the Rain? And I said, what happened was when I first started writing it, I was starting it new, and my wife was very skeptical, and she's my first editor, and she's my first reader, and she's really, really good, really good eye on things. And so I had written the first few chapters, and I gave them to her, and she just handed them back to me and said, Enzo's going to go around the world. So in a sense, I had a hint of what was, you know, I kind of knew I was onto something. When things started to go, it was a Starbucks book. It was the last Starbucks pick before there was a whole reorganization there. And then it started to go. Hardcover did okay, but when it got the paperback, it just took off. And probably it was the price point, but I think that word of mouth is what sells books. So, you know, it's important if you like a book, and not just mine, but especially mine. No, I'm kidding. Totally kidding. You know, it's not just any book. If you read a book and like it, you should tell people about it. I mean, that's how, there are no blimps carrying names of books on them. Well, maybe Stephen King or Jodi Picou or something, but normal people, there aren't that. So how do we find out about them? Word of mouth. Or you go into the bookstore that you frequent, you go into Parnassus Books, and whether or not you bought the book there, maybe you got it from the library, maybe someone loaned you a copy, doesn't matter. You go in and you say, oh, you know what? I really liked this book. And one of the people there is going to perk up and say, oh, well, maybe I should order a couple more and put them out, you know, because maybe people like this. So word of mouth is really incredibly valuable in terms of this sort of in our industry, in literature. Yes, sir.
Can you talk about your prejudice against zebras?
Can I talk about my prejudice against zebras? Do you actually like zebras? I mean, well, they are. He's talking about the zebra in the art. If you haven't read The Art of Racing in the Rain, there's a zebra, a demon zebra, who does terrible things to a frog as well as a Barbie doll, and then dismantles himself. And the zebra recurs several times throughout the book as this demon. And it's just something I've never trusted. Zebras. I don't even think they trust themselves. If you've seen what was it, Madagascar 2, Chris Rock is the zebra, and he's like, you know, he like gets freaked out when they all start imitating him and everything. He can't even tell himself apart from the other zebras. See what I'm saying? So, I mean, are they horses or what? And then are they black with white stripes or white with black stripes? I don't know. I can't. And would you ever see, like, a lion doing something like that to a frog? I wouldn't. So I took it out on a zebra. It's my book. I could do that if I want to. I have issues. Yes, sir.
When you first write your books, do you write them by hand or by computer?
Good question. Do I write my books by hand or by computer? I write by computer. I go straight to computer. I've been using the keyboard for my whole life. So I, that's my handwriting. I can't even read it when I'm done writing it. And so I can do my, I can go much faster with the computer. And there are some really cool programs out there that are really helpful for writers in terms of organizing things and moving things around. So technology in that regard, I think, is really, really good. I do have plenty of friends who are writers who write by hand still, or write parts by hand. Eric Larson, my buddy, you know, Devil in the White City and all that. Like, when he has a particularly, what he thinks is an impactful chapter, he'll write by hand to slow himself down. It's a different tactile experience. But he's way older than I am, so don't tell him I said that. Is this going to be on like video anywhere? Yes, sir.
Since you seem to be the chief cook and bottle washer,
yes,
and also spend time in the spiritual world, what does your wife do?
Yes. Well, first of all, I want you to know my true title is I'm in food acquisition and development. It's good, right? I had business cards made up with that because that's what I did. My wife is, she does a lot of weird things. I mean, in addition to running the household with, she's in traffic management, we call it. So I have an 18-year-old, a 16-year-old, and a 7-year-old. Now, things are changing now that I have two kids with driver's licenses. Did you notice how, any of you with kids who have driver's licenses, have you noticed how suddenly you don't see them anymore when they turn 16? They vanish. They're like, they're shadows. Like, they don't show up at the dinner, they're gone. You get maybe a text saying, not coming home until late. So things are changing now, but moving kids around was quite a bit of the stuff. But my wife is an energy worker. She does a lot of alternative medicine, and she does a lot of nutrition stuff. She is contemplating trying to write a book about it, but I'm not sure she wants to. It's difficult. You know, the stuff that she's working on is sort of forward thinking. This idea of blending science and spirituality together stuff, I'm not sure some people are, but society in general, I'm not sure is ready for that yet. So I get a little nervous about it, but she is my guru for the most part, and she keeps our kids healthy. It's actually quite astounding, the work that she does. I have these three kids. You see kids at school dropping a strep throat every day. You know, they're always out. I my kids haven't missed a day of school. My 18-year-old, he's a senior in high school right now. I don't think he's missed a day in school since he was 9 from illness. So she's doing something right. But I can't bottle it yet. So one day. Yes, ma'am. One more? One more. And it's you. It better be good.
Wow, this is even hard to even put out there, let alone have to be the last one. So I'm aware as a reader, of course, I project my stuff into your writing. And I'm grateful to have your writing project my stuff into. I wondered about, in Enzo and Trevor, something about the unconditional love of innocence.
Yeah.
And their effort for their flawed caregivers, their flawed elders, and that earnest effort that they seem to invest in.
Yeah. So the question is about the similarity between the idea of an innocence or an untainted view of life that exists with Enzo is also reflected through Trevor, who is, you know, in his 14-year-old years, very much so. I do believe that a lot. The thing that I'm going to answer it kind of in two parts. So the thing about Enzo I think is really cool is that I did a reading in Fort Collins, which is where Temple Grandin is from. Temple Grandin, she's high-functioning autistic, so she has Asperger's or some variation thereof. And she's done a lot of work with, very important work with killing cows. Yeah, but she identifies with animals in a way that we don't. And so she could understand how they get fear and so forth and how to make the process smoother and easier. And so I was there and I was at a reception and she came over to me and she said, I really think that teenagers identify with Enzo the dog. Why is that? And I said, geez, I don't know, Temple. Let me think about that for a minute. You know, I think it's actually pretty easy. Here's why. Because teenagers basically are Enzo. Teenagers are dogs. Or they are what Enzo feels that he is, trapped in a dog's body. In other words, Enzo thinks he's just as smart, if not smarter, than everyone else in the room. And if people would listen to him, he could explain everything. And if he could just have full access and full mobility, he could have freedom of the world, and he could change the world. And our teenagers are really, really smart. They're highly educated. We've done that on purpose. We've educated them because we want them to be really, really smart. And yet, they're not 18 yet, so they can't vote. They literally don't have a voice in our society. When they say something at a dinner table where there's adults speaking, oftentimes we marginalize what they say because we say, well, you don't really have the life experience. You don't really have, you know, what you're saying is not, doesn't really apply to what we're talking about. We marginalize them. And then when you're 14, 15 years old, what do you have to do? I want to go to the shopping mall. I want to go to a movie. I want to go do this. Mom, can you take me here? Mom, can you take me there? Dad, can you drop me off? Dad, can you come pick me up? So they're always asking for permission for everything. And so in a sense, that is a teenage tension, right? This feeling like, I just need that little bit more. So I think that that's an interesting way of looking at the world. That started with Enzo and then carried through with Trevor at 14. The reason Trevor in the Riddell family works especially well, I think, is because he is not tainted by the family history. There's five generations of this family, and terrible things have happened in this family that we learn about. But when he comes into the world, he is a blank slate. He has no judgment, he has no preconceptions, he has no prejudices about the Riddell family. Whereas everyone else, Serena, Jones, Grandpa Samuel, they're highly prejudicial about their own family history, about each other, right? Because they've built up these stories. And once we build the story, we reinforce the story. So bringing in Trevor as a young man brings him in totally clear. And so he's allowed to see things fresh. So, you know, it's a good book, A Sudden Light. You're not convinced, I know. But I want to tell you something. It took me, you know, it's taken a long time to get out. I know it's been 6 years since The Art of Racing in the Rain came out. And the reason it's taken that long is partly because the Racing in the Rain just kept going and I got caught up in that. And it's good. I have three kids. They need to go to college. Every night they say a little prayer to Enzo for their college education. But I always said to myself, it's a lot of, reading a book is a very intimate thing. It's done one person at a time. That's it. It's you and the book. And so it really is an experience that you have to invest yourself in to do it. Yeah, you have to invest money. You have to buy the book. And then you have to give time and your attention. And it's serious attention. I need all of it. I need all your, you can't like play Frisbee or you can't wash your dishes while you're reading a book. You just can't do it. So I need all of your attention and all of your time. And that's asking a lot because you're busy people. And you have a lot of other things to do and there are a lot of books you could be reading. So if I'm gonna write a book and ask you to pay money for it and give me all your time, it's gonna be the best book I've ever written. That's it. I will not compromise on that. I don't care if it takes 20 years. It's gonna be that. And this, I can honestly stand before you and say, this is the best book I've ever written. And hopefully with my next book, it's the best book. We'll see. We're starting to work on that now. But I do hope you take a chance. There are no dogs in race cars, and I know that in A Sudden Light, and I know that maybe, just as a little tidbit, maybe I'll throw a dog in the next book. I'm trying to figure out a place, but I'll definitely have a goat in the next book. and I'm serious about that. No, there already is a goat in it. So I'm not just goofing. So thank you so much for coming out. I really do appreciate it, and I'm going to be out there, you know, doing the thing that I'm supposed to be doing, and don't be responsible with those matches so I don't get in trouble. and support your libraries and support your bookstores. And whatever you do, keep reading. If you love a book, tell someone about it. And whatever you do, I see these young people here, give them books for the holidays. Make them read. Read to them, read with them, read about them. Have them write, have them read. Readers, reading is the best. It's the best pastime you could ever have. And introduce them to authors. All right, take it easy. Thank you so much for coming out.